Conyers Two Beers In Shutdown version.
Shutdown.
How are you feeling about the shutdown? I've got this sort of like morose kind of sleepwalking, daydreaming feel to it, because this was like not a very intense standoff. It was just sort of like, we'll have some votes on Friday and then the government will shut down.
Yeah,
and that's sort of what's happening.
I feel like it's a slow boil shutdown and definitely a little low energy to it. And my initial take on that has to do with sort of the partisan alignment of the shutdown, where Democrats are, you know, causing the shutdown. I know there's a lot of liberals who don't want to hear that, but the Democrats are causing this shutdown in some basic sense. And they're the party of government. And so they can't be sort of these gung-ho warriors about shutting down the government, because they like government. They think it's effective and they think it's necessary. Republicans are trying to keep the government open right now, and they're the party that typically likes smaller government and has a lot of questioning about the value of a lot of the programs. And so misaligning that sort of takes some of the energy out of the ferocity of the shutdown itself. I think the other thing going on is that the shutdown is about really big issues in some sense. Trump's spending grabs, the breakdown of the appropriations process because of the rescissions, and the general lawlessness of the Trump administration. But like, it's being fought out at a very micro level over like essentially a single policy issue now too. And that mismatch is really weird.
Yeah, well, that disjuncture is huge, yeah. Right? I mean, it's like it's an enormous ocean between the reason that the base of the Democratic Party wants a shutdown and the reason they want to fight, and the reason that their leaders are saying they're shutting down the government over essentially ACA subsidies.
Yeah.
And I think I kind of read that as like, this is the most favorable terrain on which leaders feel they can fight a shutdown, because at the end of the day, Democrats are not going to get their wish list. Like, they're not going to cave on impoundment. They're not going to cave on rescission. They're not going to cave on any of, like, they're not going to rebuild USAID. They're not going to, I mean, none of that stuff is coming back.
Right. Russ Lowe's not getting fired.
Right.
Right.
At least not yet. So it's like, it feels like this is an issue where they thought they could win on. And I'm not sure that they'll actually get it. I thought it was maybe the most winnable of the issues that they could get on there, but it's kind of weird for them to come right out of the gate of negotiation and be like, here's what we want. It's yeah. Like,
I mean, I think they will get the ACA subsidies extension in the end, probably, maybe with some changes, if only because I think the Republican frontliners want it too.
Yeah.
And so one way you can read the ACA fight is that the leaders need to sort of appease their bases right now by digging in. And then they'll cut a deal that actually the Republicans probably would have wanted to cut anyway down the road once they proved they were, you know, standing up.
Right. And none of this, but none of this really touches like the reason that there's a shutdown, right?
Correct.
The reason that there's a shutdown is because Democrats can't and don't feel that if they vote for an appropriations bill,
that
appropriations bill will be implemented with fidelity to the deal.
And in some sense,
like,
there
are a couple things with that, right? The rescissions thing is something that's popped up a little bit. Like, Republicans did his first successful rescission in how long?
First successful Impoundment Control Act rescission,
yes.
Right? That can be done on a party line basis.
Correct.
Now, the thing to remember is that rescissions are all over these appropriations bills, but they are rescissions that got the 60-vote bipartisan threshold, right? The ICA rescissions are a process by which if the president propose a rescission, it has fast track through the Senate, so it only needs 50 votes. So as it's seen now, these 60 vote deals on appropriations can be undone by a party with just 50 votes. And that is sort of the rub.
Yeah.
There's nothing illegal or Trump power grabby about that. It's just undermining the deals in the Senate with kind of the process Congress set up. And that's why it's so frustrating to me.
One of the things that I think is, I think this has sort of been made a bigger deal than it actually is. I think in theory, yeah, like having a 60-vote threshold to pass appropriations bills and then a 51-vote threshold to repeal that deal. Like, yeah, like that sort of sucks. But I think even like, wow, we were in a new space and like there was some slamming of the door.
Yeah.
Sorry. I think even in the minority, you can kind of accept a majority decision, right? It's like, here's 51 votes. They did it through a legal process. It got a majority in the House. It got a majority in the Senate. We don't love it, but it's still a majority decision. Like, what is really something that is like absolutely undermining the trust of Democrats is the impoundments, right?
Yes.
It's just like,
100%.
And pocket rescissions, right? This idea like, oh, all of a sudden rescissions are authorized in the last 45 days of a fiscal year.
I mean,
it's insane.
It's insane. And I agree that that is the ire. The problem I see that relates to these two things is that the ICA process, that is that 50 vote process, is the process you want the Trump administration taking instead of the pocket rescissions and the impoundments. You want them submitting rescission requests for Congress to approve. And that's like sort of the way this should work. But the way it's set up to work is not great right now because of the disparity between the 60 and 50 votes.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I 100% agree that, like, the bigger deal here is the executive basically deciding that they're going to make spending decisions.
Yes, right. I mean, that just breaks all the norms, all the laws, right? All the constitutions, everything. Right? All right. The things.
And that's really 500 years of Anglo-American practice out the window.
Right, exactly. It's gonna disrupt some things. And I think that it's hard. That's one reason I think it's hard to see an end, right? It's going to be a slow attrition, I think. And this, because the base is not going to be satisfied. I don't think any deal that's struck here is going to really satisfy the itch that many Democratic voters want scratched.
I think that's right. And then this gets sort of the conundrum Schumer's in, which is that I think he thought, or maybe thought, that a little bit of fight here would set him up and secure him. But now he's got a problem, which is the initial polling isn't that bad for the Democrats. And so it's like, when do you cut this off and how do you cut this off?
Yeah, let's talk about the polling. So the Post did a poll, and of 1,000 people, 47% blamed Trump at the administration versus 30% for Democrats. And that's surprising. That's not sort of the way that these typically go. When you have a shutdown, normally the party shutting down the government gets the blame. We saw that when Democrats shut down DHS in 2015. Right. We saw that in 2018-19. We saw that in 2013. Like, that's been the sort of norm. You shut down the government, or if you're the one making a demand on government funding.
I mean, we got to be crystal clear on this. Like, the Democrats are the ones shutting down the government. I agree with the liberals who say the Republicans have abdicated the appropriations process. They haven't bargained. They didn't pass the bills in the House. That is the reason the appropriation bills are late.
Right.
It's the reason we don't have them on October 1st. That said, if you just pass CRs, the government stays open, and the people blocking the CRs are Democrats. You can't fight this out in the New York Times opinion page for 6 months and then put it into effect and then say you didn't do it.
Yeah.
They did it.
Right. And so, like, this polling has been really interesting to watch because it sort of flies in the face of conventional wisdom.
Absolutely.
When you're looking at these shutdowns. And, like, it's raised a couple of questions for me. One, who are the 1,000 people that the Washington Post was able to get into a sample, right? The people who's most likely to pick up the phone? It might be a more Democratic-friendly audience at the current moment. And two, I think the other thing that's really surprising is, like, the president's, like, kind of unpopular right now. Yeah. And, like, these things don't operate in a void, right? If you sit there and you ask somebody who's to blame for a shutdown, and you already have a negative opinion of the president, which is true nowadays, his approval is, like, hovering around 42-41%, like, then it's going to kind of... it's going to affect other questions on that particular survey, right? And I don't really know. We're going to have to see another survey or another couple surveys. But at the bare minimum, you're right. This is going to, it does nothing but extend the potential.
I see a couple things at play here with the public opinion. One is I do expect it to get worse for the Democrats as time goes on. But one thing that could be true is that these sorts of questions now may have just hardened into which side are you on.
Yeah.
And the president's not popular right now.
Yep.
And you may have just seen a hardening of this. The other thing you have here is that the Democrats now are really trying to message that this is not their shutdown, which is a change from previous shutdowns. In 13, there's almost an exuberance among the Republicans to shut the government down. And in 18, Trump kind of owned it, like, self-admittedly. This is sort of a shutdown where the Democrats are running away from the shutdown as fast as possible. Certainly aren't proud of it.
Right.
Which may muddy the polling as well, too.
Right.
But I do expect it to get worse for them. You know, we haven't had a full survey in the field of full length that has been post-shutdown.
Right.
Nor have we had sort of a missed paycheck from federal workers. One of the mistakes people make about a shutdown is they see it as like a stalemate, but like the pressure builds during it.
Yeah.
You know, especially after those federal workers miss a paycheck, more and more people get a vacation messed up, the airport lines get worse. Like, it's not a static thing.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that this has been an interesting point that you brought up is you know, Democrats are sort of running away from the shutdown. That's absolutely true. And I think the notion behind the shutdown, at least if you're in like the Ezra Klein sort of like blogosphere and some people on the left, is that the shutdown was a moment to grab the attention of the country and make your point, right? Where it's like, we're going to all rally behind this shutdown because everything is all in chaos, and we need a moment to focus attention on what's going on and to bring people's attention to everything that's been happening, right? The problem is that, like, party leaders, like particularly Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries, are not built for this sort of thing, right? They have completely different goals, right? If you're going to sit there and be like, who are the thought leaders of the Democratic Party shaping public opinion, it's not Chuck Schumer, right? It's like, look, we're talking about all the things, right? He's just not that guy. And party leaders aren't that person either. I mean, like, as a position, they're not going out there to shape public opinion. They are coalition managers, right? They want to keep everybody from defecting. They want to find agreement where they can. They want to get their people reelected. They're not going out there to make a bold stance. And we've seen leaders who have taken these bold stances, like Newt Gingrich, for example, lasted a very short time in leadership because those big, bold public opinion standoffs, like, ended in debacle, right? And a bunch of the party were like, I don't want this guy leading us anymore. We don't need more of these types of standoffs.
And this is sort of like the crux of the Ezra Klein theory problem, which is that if you're trying to get attention, there's two problems with that. One is that as soon as you have a shutdown, all the attention goes on the shutdown.
Yes.
And the question of when the government's going to reopen and how is it hurting people. So you end up with a space where it's harder to get your message out. But two, if you really believe sort of the Klein theory, you have to accept that we are owning this because we need, because we need the attention. So you have to say, yes, we're shutting the government down because the stakes are so high.
Right.
And if you're running away from that and saying the Republicans are shutting the government down, then like, what the hell are you, what is happening?
Yeah. And what's happening is you got two congressional leaders who have no interest in doing this thing, running the shutdown, right? I mean, there's no Democratic leader right now. There's no nominee. There's no president. There's no one rallying force. Like, Henry Clay's not hanging around anywhere, like, in some sort of like really eloquent legislator who can kind of get people on his side. It's just, there's nobody leading the party because they're in the minority right now. And so what you get is this sort of like hodgepodge reaction, like, oh, it's about healthcare, when it's not about healthcare. Yeah. And so it's this really big disjuncture within the Democratic Party. You have two leaders who are not built to lead this thing, kind of like backed into this condition of a shutdown, and then sort of like trying to make a public case for it. And the public case is, it's not really our shutdown, it's about healthcare. Right? It's like everybody's sort of like, wait a second. Like, this is not what we signed up for, sort of thing. It's been a very interesting dynamic to watch on the Democratic side as it kind of fumbled through this.
Yeah. And on that point, excuse me, I'm trying to eat some popcorn here. That was a big mistake. The other thing that has happened is that there's no way to have a singular message on this.
Right.
You had 19,000 different Democrats telling you 19,002 different things about this shutdown. So, I think the other thing that has to do with the polling is that Trump and Vogt really aren't on the same page as the congressional Republicans right now. And in some ways, Trump and Vogt are getting in their way.
Yeah, there was some interesting, before you go on, there was some interesting comments from members just a little while ago. OMB Director Russ Vogt was talking to House Republicans, and two House Republicans piped up and said, don't do the mass firing, right? That's essentially where we're at. Like, don't do the mass firings. This has been threatened before the shutdown. It was clearly being, like, you know, kind of floated ahead of in advance of the shutdown. And then there was talk at that particular conference about this, and you had two Republicans. You had, is it Blake Moore from Utah and Brian Babbins from Texas? These are not moderates who are piping up and saying, like, don't do the mass firing sort of thing. And so it seems like there might be more pushback than previously anticipated.
Yeah, and it might even just be not necessarily policy pushback, which I think some of it is, but it can also be political pushback in the sense that the basic Thune Republican message is, we don't negotiate with hostage takers, you need to reopen the government, and we can't give you anything because that'll just encourage more of it. And now, for their own sort of ideological reasons, Vogt and Trump, in some sense, are also taking hostages.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of muddying the message of sort of who is trying to take advantage of the shutdown here. You saw Senator Kramer yesterday.
Senator North Dakota.
Right? Really blasting Vogt and saying, dude, we have the moral high ground here. You got to stop this stuff. You're not helping our cause, basically. I'm paraphrasing. But I do think that one thing the Democrats, maybe you know you can count on this, is that Trump is going to stumble over things and not play sort of ideal public opinion politics with this. And maybe we're seeing that reflected in the polls. But my basic take is that we need to wait a little longer on the polls.
Yeah.
And see where we are next week. I take it you don't have any hope that this is going to be resolved before Monday, right?
No. They're going to take a vote today. It's definitely going to fail. And then it was really interesting. Senator Majority Leader Thune was like, we'll have votes into the weekend. And then walked that back real quick. I was like, even when he said that, it's like, we're staying over the weekend? Like, senators don't like that.
I mean, when you hear the Senate is staying over the weekend, usually that's a good signal that something's going to happen.
Yeah.
Right? Senators don't stay over the weekend to take nonsense test votes.
Yes.
And, you better have an emergency, any solution to the emergency if you want them to vote on Saturday. And so I don't think you'll see a vote for this till at least Monday evening.
Yeah.
Or maybe Tuesday. And, it, you know, and And again, even a week from this weekend, I don't think you're going to see the Senate there unless you have a solution or you think you may have a solution, which I don't think anyone thinks they have this weekend. Now, the House come back next week, which is going to certainly amp up the screaming on the Hill.
Meanwhile, let's talk about the chamber that hasn't been around.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's been interesting that they've essentially tried to stick the Senate with, you know, this particular bill and, like, not leave it. It's a little anticlimactic, but, I mean, just because, like, the Senate's not going to approve it, right? It's they're stuck in this filibuster.
Right. I mean, you have other things going on in the House, too, right now, which is that the Grijalva swearing in is going to give the discharge petition on the Epstein stuff 218 votes, and then the clock is going to get going on that. And so, like, how is that going to fit into the politics? That's going to fit into the politics. And so, like, you can find every conspiracy theory under the sun for why the House isn't here. But I think the basic reason the House isn't here is because they don't have anything to do right now on this, right? And they don't want sort of anyone to get any ideas or start playing any games either.
Right. If they can keep their members away from cameras for another week, that would be fantastic.
Yeah.
Because Thomas Massie is finding ways to get in front of them.
Yeah.
He is, I mean, even on the recess, he and Senator Paul were...
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, one piece of sort of big voting news right now is that on the final vote before... we actually had the shutdown. You had a 55-45 vote. And again, you need 60 affirmative votes to get cloture on an appropriations bill. And so you had three Democrats or three Democratic caucusers. You had King, the independent from Maine, and you had Fetterman from Pennsylvania and Cortez Masto from Nevada vote with the Republicans to open the government. You also had Rand Paul vote the other way.
Yeah.
He will never vote for anything on the spending side. So there you go. But that is sort of where you are baseline right now. You already have three Democrats side of the Republicans, and to the degree that more sort of feel pressure to do that, or centrists feel pressure to sort of form a so-called gang in the Senate, you might see some actual movement that doesn't come from the leaders, but that comes from the middle. It doesn't seem like the leaders are talking that much right now.
No.
But you do have some people in the middle talking, and that is the other way sometimes actually gets forced in the Senate.
Yeah. I don't know how much this, you know, quote-unquote potential gang is actually doing. I mean, they gathered together on the Senate floor. There were discussions. Like, it sounded like it was really raw. Like, nothing was decided. They didn't do it. I mean, that's sort of what you expect a day or two into a shutdown, right? Like, before we can, like, get to the good ideas, like, all the bad ideas need to be officially tabled by the other side.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I don't know how much this is going to funnel through any sort of gang. I don't have much hope. This, I mean, when's the last time a gang was successful?
I mean, the most famous gang is the 2005 gang that negotiated the appointments during the Bush administration. You had attempts at gangs during immigration.
Right. 2014, 2013, that area. That was Bob Corker, John McCain, and a bunch of Democrats. They were going to get like $50 billion for like border wall money. Yeah. And that gang, did the Senate pass that bill?
I can't remember.
It died in the House either way. Like, it never became law. But like, the gangs are really sort of like, it's sort of a relic at this point.
I mean, yes, they are. There are just so few issues that have sort of the cross-party appeal to that crowd. But it is sort of, it's an alternative strategy to pursue, to put pressure on the leaders. Obviously, the leaders have their own incentives. And the gangs also are counteracting the bases, right? Which in both sides relish these sorts of fights.
Yeah.
And again, this is part of the coalition management that Schumer and Thune are dealing with right now. And certainly a piece of this that sits outside of sort of public opinion or the New York Times editorial page, which is just like, how do you keep your Senate caucus together?
Yeah. As a side note, what's more dumb, a gang in the Senate or the Problem Solvers Caucus in the House?
Problem Solvers. I mean, that's not, I mean, come on.
I heard they're officially disbanding or something. Oh, going to be unofficially disbanded.
Whatever that means, right? They made their status official.
Yeah. But it's the funny thing, right? I mean, like, the idea that moderates are going to, like, push a deal, like, they're going to negotiate the deal. That's sort of like a little far-fetched, right? I mean, can moderates force the hand of leaders? Yeah, they can. Especially if you start to see more defections as, like, the Senate pushes more and more votes, and you see five Democrats peel off, and then six Democrats peel off. Well, at that point in time, Chuck Schumer is going to have to, like, wave the white flag. But I don't see them, like, the gang of Senate moderate senators in the Senate, like, getting together and, like, hashing out a deal that they then present to leaders as an acceptable alternative. That seems a little bit, I don't know, that seems weird now.
Yeah, one thing to watch on the radar, too, is the other set of actors here who are sort of Democratic primary challengers out for Senate seats. This is something Tim Alberta told me, must be a decade ago now, as we watched so many sort of competitive Republicans lose primaries in states where they probably could have won elections to sort of radicals, right? This is the Christine O'Donnell effect, right? And Sharon Angle, right? And you just go down the list of Senate seats the Republicans threw away in the 2010s by primary challengers who are radicals defeating really high-quality candidates. And Alberta told me, I don't know when it was, he's like, this is coming for the Democrats sooner or later. And you can kind of see the angling of that now, where sort of the most gung-ho shut the government down people are sort of these Democratic candidates for Senate seats that are sort of not the best general election candidates. You can see it around the country in different places where it looks like if they win primaries, you just got to write the seat off, right? Yeah. And they're not places where the Democrats are like strong contenders, but take a place like Iowa, where the right Democrat in the right moment could win a Senate seat, in my view. But not the wrong Democrat in any moment, right? And I worry that sort of the spreading of this base politics that we saw sort of just entangled Republicans in knots for so many years is now coming to the left too.
Yeah, it's something that that's on my radar. I mean, we saw how the Tea Party affected the Republicans after 2010. I mean, that was a wave election that had an absolute ton of much more ideologically, much more conservative Republicans come on. And like, this kind of feels like the Democratic version of that, right? Where this is a moment where Democrats are like being forced to fight, they're really pushing hard, and they want people who are going to demonstrate and stand up and do all that stuff. Well, those people are not always the most moderate, right? Or necessarily the best one for that particular district or state. So it's going to be interesting to watch, because this has, you know, this has implications further down the road too. I mean, like Chuck Schumer, his job is on the line kind of at the moment, right? Is he somebody who the base and many candidates will accept? I mean, there are a lot of candidates right now in Democratic primaries who are saying they will not support Chuck Schumer should they get elected to the Senate.
And he's super unpopular.
Right, and his approval is like 17%. That's like, it's really bad. It's lower than Congress's approval, right? And so it's super terrible. And I don't know if he I mean, I'm sure he understands the position that he's in, but I mean, he's kind of like going through the shutdown to hold on and save face with the people that are abandoning him. But at the same time, like, I don't know if he's going to be able to get out of this, right? I mean, he may be like John Boehner, where he just simply can't keep outrunning the flank.
Yeah. And you know, there's the question of not only his leadership position in the Senate, which I think may be toast come,
Congress,
or the one after, but there's also his seat. Right, where you have sort of AOC sort of not in sort of like an open secret sitting there sort of eyeing it, right? And you see sort of her and, you know, Bernie filming these videos, and they actually seem like they're the ones with all the momentum in the Democratic Party. And that has a very sort of mirror to sort of Tea Party aspect to it.
Yeah, it's going to be really, really interesting to watch. But it's going to have a lot of implications. So we'll keep an eye on that. But it's shaping up. This is going to be a much more radical, kind of like hostile Democratic Party after this. I think, you know, this isn't going to be like the good government types necessarily. I mean, maybe they are, but it'll be a different kind of Democratic coalition.
And they're coming out of the shutdown, and they're not going to get what they want either, is the other thing, right? And so they get the ACA subsidies, and Chuck Schumer is going to say, look, we got it. This is a nice victory, right? And everyone who wanted the shutdown is going to throw their hands up in the air and say nothing was accomplished at all.
Yeah.
And so I think that the basic take of anyone who was demanding this shutdown is going to be like, what do we get?
Right.
It's a pyrrhic victory. And that wasn't hard to predict, or I guess we're still predicting it, but like, there was just no way. Just like Obama was not going to sign a bill to repeal Obamacare.
Right.
Trump ain't signing on to tying his own hands over executive power. It's not happening.
Yeah. Yeah, this is like one of the bigger problems with the institution, generally speaking, right? I mean, Congress is in a position where they can't get power back. I mean, like, the partisan incentives are just so distorting any sort of bipartisanship. And there was an interesting question, like, if Democrats did win in 29, do you see reforms to the institution? I mean, like, they had this idea going under Biden, right? After Trump won, like, we're going to pass this, the For the People Act or whatever it was. That was going to put in place like better protections for whistleblowers, more protections for IGs, better protections for like appointees and all this other stuff. And then Biden got in office and it simply kind of disappeared. Like the idea that we're going to do this like massive reform package just went away. And like, I don't know if like the scales are going to shift if they win again, right?
I can't see it. I think there's going to be such a temptation to sort of, at least in a judicial, you know, judicious manner, do some of the same things Trump did in other ways, right? And that may be for retribution or vengeance, but it may just be for like, well, this is easier to do, right? It's a path of least resistance, right? And there's going to be plenty of Democrats who are going to sit there and justify it and say, well, look, they did it to us. Why don't we do it to them? We have the power. Why don't we use it? And that's a very compelling argument for short-term substantive political goals and a very bad argument for long-term congressional power over spending.
Right. But it raises a lot of questions about, like, you know, what kind of independence should these agencies have? Like, you know, how, what kind of hiring practices should we put in place? Firing practices? I mean, they may want to tighten some of those things, but, like, I just don't see, like, the partisan nature of it and the two-thirds threshold, essentially, because this president has to sign off on losing power. It's like, almost impossible.
I don't see how a Democrat who won in 2029 wouldn't want to clean out ICE from a personnel level side, right?
Right.
Maybe not new to the agency, but sort of take anyone who was involved sort of at any level with the Trump administration in this and remove them. And that is going to be something that calls into question, like, the authority of the president again. And plenty of Democrats are going to go, like, it's fucking ICE. Of course we should be able to do this. And it's like, well,
right,
you know, that's a great substantive goal, right? I may even agree with it, but, like, this is not really the route to sort of congressional authority.
Right. And it's really kind of depressing in that respect, right? Like, Congress doesn't have a way back of getting power at the moment. But that's kind of where we're at the moment. This is a fast episode. In any event, that's it for us. We'll be back, I guess, in a week, maybe.
I think we'll do an episode next week and see where we are.
And we'll be talking probably more shutdown, but in case something else changes, we might be back.
See ya.